This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In the 1950s, Canada relocated Inuit families from the east coast of Hudson Bay, 1,200 miles to the north, to Ellesmere Island. The government said the Inuit would be allowed to return to Hudson Bay. They were not. Why were the Inuit moved? The U.S. saw Cold War strategic advantage in the Arctic. Canada, meanwhile, wanted to hang on to its sovereignty. On the program today, a conversation with Melanie McGrath. She is the author of The Long Exile, a tale of Inuit betrayal and survival in the high Arctic. Also part of this story is the making of the Robert Flaherty film, Nanook of the North, the 1922 movie about an Eskimo hunter and his family. While Flaherty was in the North, he fathered a son, Josefi. Robert's half-Inuit son, who never met his father, was one of the people removed to Ellesmere Island. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest, Melanie McGrath. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Melanie McGrath is the award-winning author of four books now. She's a regular contributor to The Guardian, The Times, The Telegraph, and The Evening Standard. She's also produced television shows for the Discovery Channel and the United Kingdom's Channel 4. She makes her home in London. Her latest book, The Long Exile, is published by Knopf. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Melanie McGrath, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's good to speak with you. What was your introduction to these stories that tell in The Long Exile? The story of the removal of the Inuit and the story of the Flahertys.
Well, I've been very, very lucky in my life. I've done a lot of traveling, and particularly among Indigenous peoples, I spent time with pygmies in the Congo jungle, and I lived for a while in Central America and had some contact with the Indians living in the rainforest there and out in the Kalahari Desert. And I have always been interested in indigenous and survive in what are often incredibly extreme environments. There's nowhere more extreme as an environment for human habitation than the Arctic. So I'd always been interested in Inuit people, and I'd come across this story partly in a former life working as a film critic. I'd been very interested in Nanook of the North, which regularly gets the top spots for one of the most influential documentaries ever made, despite the fact that it's nearly 100 years old now. And influenced people like Orson Welles and Charlie Chaplin and John Huston. And I think it was the combination of those two interests came together in this particular story. But I think there was another element too, and that was that I was conscious that the Arctic story had been told so often in terms of white exploration and almost never in terms of from the point of view of the Inuit themselves. And of course, I'm not Inuit, so there's a limit to the degree to which I can get into the Inuit mind, but I felt that their point of view about the Arctic needed to be represented and wasn't being.
Yeah. Speaking of trying to see the world through another pair of eyes or another set of eyes, maybe you would share here with our listeners the request of readers you make at the end of the preface to The Long Exile.
Yeah, I thought it was important to stress that Inuit people are not necessarily very, psychologically speaking, not necessarily very instantly recognizable to people who've grown up in Western cultures. Because their cultures require different kinds of psychological responses from them. And Inuit people, for example, tend to live in small settlements. There's very little social mobility. They're with the same people year in, year out, mostly their whole lives. The family is the center of their world. And because of the environments they're living in, there are certain kind of psychological responses that the Inuit simply find unacceptable. So rage would be one of those. Sexual jealousy is another of them. And so when I told the story, I didn't want a Western audience to look at the plight of these people and think, well, why didn't they do anything? Because actually, in their terms, they did everything that they possibly could have done. And I think it's important to come to the story with some kind of understanding of the psychological differences and responses that you and I might have had in the same situation and that they had in the situation that they found themselves in.
Yeah. I think at some point in the book you use the words ruthless disregard when it comes to how these people were treated.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Canadian Commission on Human Rights called it one of the greatest human rights abuses in Canada, and I think it's fair to say that. The extraordinary thing about it was that none of this was malicious. By and large, it was done by people who had convinced themselves, civil servants and politicians and so on, who had convinced themselves that what they were doing was for the good of the Inuit. The trouble was they didn't take the time or trouble to ask the Inuit. And I think one of the great lessons from this story is that in a democracy, you have to ask people what their feelings about their own lives are, that you can't dictate people's lives, whatever you might think of them, and however distant and remote they might be.
Yeah. Unthinking. It was done without any thought, without any care, and the result was horrific.
Well, I think there were so many misconceptions about the Arctic by Westerners, most of whom, even the ones who were in the Canadian administration governing the Arctic, so many misconceptions about what the Arctic actually was, which were established by the white explorers and had never really been challenged, mostly for the reason that most Westerners never got up there. So the sense, for example, that you could move people 1,200 miles, which is the equivalent of, say, moving people from Chicago to Mexico or New York to Cuba, and that conditions would be more or less the same because it was all one big white blob, was very much part of their thinking. But, of course, the Arctic is a vast region, and within that region there are enormous variations. And one of them being that the high Arctic to where the Inuit were moved is a desert. It's as much a desert as the Sahara or the Mojave or any other desert. And despite of our sense of the Arctic being covered in snow and white and the rest of it, there is no snow up there. So these people were living in snow houses, suddenly found that they were somewhere 1,200 miles north where it was regularly minus 50, minus 55 degrees with no snow to make snow houses. And that was just one example of the many, many, many misconceptions that the Canadian government had about what the Arctic actually was.
Yeah. And for 4 months of the year, it's dark.
Completely dark, yeah.
So
the sun sets in October, and it rises again around Valentine's Day, about mid-February, which is a kind of bizarre concept for anyone who lives south of the Arctic Circle. The idea that the sun rises and sets every day is so much part of our everyday assumption about life, but in the Arctic you can't make that assumption. For 4 months of the year there is no sun, and on the other side for 4 months of the year there is 24-hour daylight, and I've been up in the Arctic and during 24-hour daylight, and that in its way is just as disorienting as the complete darkness.
So how does one survive or try to survive in such a place?
Well, that was one of the things that most fascinated fascinated me, and I had most, particularly as I went further into researching the book and I went up to the Arctic a couple of times, the incredible resilience of these people, their enormous capacity for adapting to this incredibly difficult terrain, which is so much based on knowing it intimately. I was just really filled with admiration when I was up there at the delicacy with which they understood the environment in a way that I knew I would never be able to. I mean, they could smell things on the wind I couldn't smell. They could see things I couldn't see. They only had to touch your skin to be able to determine your body temperature. You know, they have such tremendous skills that someone living in, certainly someone living in London or in any big city, we've lost those skills for generations.
Mm. And there are people still living there on the island of Ellesmere.
Yes, there are still about 50 people living up there. Most of them, well, I think all of them, are survivors of the original relocation or their children. Many had tried to move back to Inuktitut, where they had come from originally. But, of course, children who were born up there, for them, Ellesmere Island is home. So there was a lot of splitting of families, and this isn't like it would be if, your family moved from Chicago to Mexico. You'd get on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
But there are hardly any planes, and the ones there are mostly military planes, and the costs are absolutely fantastic. I mean, you would be paying $10,000 to get down to see your family, and these people simply couldn't afford that. So many of them rather reluctantly decided to remain on Ellesmere just so that they could keep their families together.
Mm. And what, in contrast, what is life like in Inuktitut?
Well, Inuktitut, where these people originally came from, is, to put it in context, it's way below the Arctic Circle. It's much further south than Alaska. For any of your listeners familiar with Britain, it's on about the same latitude as Inverness, Scotland. So although it's an Arctic climate, it's very southern, very much the southern Arctic borders. They're just on the tree line, so just below them there are trees. There are plenty of caribou. There are plenty of sea mammals in the waters. They get a lot of berries. There's Arctic willow. It's very, it's still Arctic, but it's very fertile Arctic. It's green. It's willow covered. The growing season is longer. It's just a very much more, and you and I would still find it very, very tough to survive there. But it's a very much more mellow environment than Ellesmere, which, as I said, is one of the world's cold deserts.
Yeah. Well, now tell us, let's talk about Robert Flaherty and who he was, and talk with us about his love of wilderness and his introduction to the Inuit of the Hudson Bay.
Well, Robert was the son of Irish immigrants who come into the States via Quebec from Ireland. I think probably sometime during or shortly after the potato famine in the 1860s. And they had settled in Michigan, which at the time was rough, very rough mining country. Robert's father, who was also called Robert, had become a mine manager. He'd done very well for himself, and he owned his own little mine. And he also went around prospecting around Michigan for mostly for iron ore. And so Robert grew up into, he was the eldest of seven children. He grew up into a prosperous middle-class life, but very much one that was based in the rural parts of kind of wild country, really. He never settled in the city. His parents, despairing of him ever making anything of himself, him to various colleges in Toronto and so on, and he was expelled from all of them. He was something of a rebel. He just really wanted to follow his father into the mining camps, and they included camps in northern Ontario, which at that time was very much a wilderness terrain. And Robert really discovered himself there. He spent a lot of time with the local Indians, learning how to hunt rabbits and follow tracks and so on. And he really became a kind of a woodsman. And he never lost his, even when he came back down to the South, he never lost his love of that environment, and always determined that he would go back. And eventually his parents stopped pestering him to settle down and become normal, gave him his head, and off he went exploring for iron ore in Ontario, and gradually making his way further and further north to the Hudson Bay. He arrived in Hudson Bay in 1914 and did some prospecting and found some iron ore there, and came back and reported his findings. He was sponsored to go out another two or three times during that period. And the more he went out, the more he realized that iron ore bored him. And actually what really interested him was the people he was meeting up there. And he felt that they were somehow quite pure and robust, and they weren't degraded in the way that a lot of the people in the South he felt had been degraded. He loved the freedom of their lives. He loved their resilience. And he began to take pictures on his trips. And as it turned out, his pictures began to be more successful than his iron ore expeditions, his prospecting expeditions. And around 1914, 1915, he decided that he wanted to make a movie of these people's lives, and because they were obviously quite unknown in the South. And he took up with him a movie camera, a very early movie camera, and began taking film, and got back down to the South and dropped a cigarette on it, and the whole thing went up in flames. So there he was, with no more money and no more prospects mm-hmm. for going back up to the north, until 1920, when he happened to meet a guy called Thierry, Captain Thierry, at a cocktail party in New York. And Thierry was working for a fur company called the Revillon Frères, who were in big competition with the Hudson Bay Company at the time. And he wanted to kind of cut a splash for the Revillon Frères. I think it was their 350th anniversary. And Robert was quite a chancer, and he decided that this was his opportunity. And he said, well, I'll make you a film. I'll make you a movie of these Inuit people, Eskimos, as they were called then. It will take the world by storm, and everyone will know that it was sponsored by Revillon Frères. This whole idea was quite revolutionary in the time, and it became one of the first sponsored films. Thierry rather liked the idea, and he got the money together. And in the summer of 1920, Robert Flaherty made his way up north to the Hudson Bay. This was no easy business at that time. It took him about 2 or 3 months. It involved all sorts of canoeing up rivers and portages and getting onto sailing ships and goodness knows what else. But he was absolutely determined that this was his life's purpose. And after many adventures and setbacks, and a couple of which he nearly lost his life, he arrived in the little settlement of Inuktitut in the summer of 1920, and set himself up in the fur trader's store, and cast his cast, his crew, and his stars. What he wanted to do was to show the world what life was like up in the Arctic, what traditional life had been like. In fact, because of the interference by whaler, European and American whalers and fur traders, life in the Arctic had already changed by the time Robert Flaherty got up there. But he wasn't really interested in telling that story. What he wanted to represent was the life as it had been. So he found himself one of the great hunters of the region, who was a man called Alakarialak. But that was a little bit difficult to say, so he changed the guy's name to Nanook, which means polar bear. And he cast a woman who was, in fact, Alakarialak's sister-in-law to play Nanook's wife. And her name was Maggie Nujaluktuk. And for the film, he decided to call her Nyla, which means smiling one. And over the next year that followed, he and Nanook and Nyla spent most days out filming. They filmed walrus hunts. They tried to film a polar bear hunt, which all went terribly wrong and nearly ended up with the deaths of all of them. They filmed Nyla with her baby. They filmed Nanook going to the fur trader. And he got together during that year, he got together about 14,000 feet of film, which was a heck of a lot of film. And he had terrible technical problems up there. The film froze. The cameras got condensed. He couldn't get them working. They were all hand-wound cameras at that point. He couldn't get them working properly because the handles froze up. It was the most tremendous effort and a great testament to his determination and his what had become his great love letter to the people of the North. During that time, he also was quite literally having a love affair with Maggie Nujaluktuk, and towards the end of the filming period, she became pregnant. But there was never any chance that they would get together. She spoke almost no English. He spoke very little Inuktitut, which was is the local language. He was also married, which was another inconvenient fact, and had several daughters living back in Connecticut. They were living at that time. So when the summer of 1921 arrived and he'd got his film, Robert Flaherty got on a ship and sailed back home. And he never went back to the Arctic, even though Nanook of the North became his most successful film by a long, long way. And for the whole of the rest of his career, he was known always as the director of Nanook of the North. In fact, Nanook became it opened in New York in 1922 and became an almost overnight word-of-mouth sensation and began to open up in theaters all across the states. It then crossed the pond and opened in London, in Paris. It got as far as Beijing, Malaysia, Australia, and it became a huge global brand. And within 5 years of the film coming out, the word Nanook had been adopted into the Malaysian language, and still is, I believe, still the word for strongman. Robert Flaherty was a celebrated filmmaker. He was wooed by Hollywood, but he was an irascible old creature, and he couldn't really get on with Hollywood's ways, so he and Hollywood very soon parted. But Nanook was the making of him. Up in the North, the people who had starred in Nanook knew nothing about its success, and in fact, very sadly, 2 years after the film was first premiered, Alakarialak, the hunter who played Nanook, died of starvation. out on the ice. And Maggie Nujaluktuk had a son, Robert Flaherty's son, who she called Giuseppe, after Robert's middle name, which was Joseph.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Melanie McGrath. Her latest book is The Long Exile, a tale of Inuit betrayal and survival in the high Arctic. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. When Robert Flaherty left Hudson Bay in late summer of 1921, did he know Maggie was pregnant?
Well, we'll never know. I suspect that he did, and I think there's evidence that he did. He never mentioned having a son or a half Inuit child in any of his dispatches. He was profiled all over. He was profiled in the New Yorker. BBC did a big documentary series about him. So he had plenty of opportunities for making this fact known and never did. I went through, as part of my research, I went through his diaries, which are now at Columbia University in New York, and there was nothing mentioning the son then. But we have a tiny bit of evidence to suggest that he did know this, which is that in 1953, 2 years after Robert Flaherty died, his brother David took a boat to Inuktitut and asked to meet Giuseppe Flaherty and took pictures of him. Now, if he hadn't known about Giuseppe Flaherty, mm-hmm. one assumes that he wouldn't have done that. But that's as far as the evidence goes. And the fact that Giuseppe was born in December, on Christmas Day, in fact, 1921, and Flaherty had left the settlement of Inuktitut at the end of August. So Maggie would have been something like 5 months pregnant at the time, which quite difficult to hide.
Yeah. I wonder what this was like to live with this secret, by and large, except for the brother. You know, here's a fellow who's captivated by the people and the land. He makes Nanuk of the North as kind of a valentine to this place. You say in your book, in this place, he found in emptiness, he began to find a fullness, to comprehend a fullness. Being separated from all of this, he never went back to the Arctic. I wonder what that would have been like for him.
Well, who knows? And he's not around to ask.
Right.
I did have a short correspondence with one of his daughters, but I think for obvious reasons, she didn't really want to get into that particular part of Robert's life. And I can only imagine that he, in the mores of the time, this was something that was perfectly acceptable to do. It was certainly true that there were many, many children of white fathers and Inuit mothers around the Arctic at the time, because most of the white men who were posted up there were posted for several years as fur traders or missionaries and so on, and there weren't any white women up there. And even the ones who were married often didn't take their wives up there because conditions were so harsh. So they were looking for company, and although there was a law saying that that men were obliged to keep their children and pay for their children, no one ever enforced it, and no one ever could enforce it up in the Arctic.
Mm. What was Maggie's family life like? And what was her situation then when Robert left?
Well, it's very difficult to know exactly what Maggie's life was like because so much of For a start, the Inuit find it very difficult to talk about their dead. That's something that they find disrespectful. So you have to kind of read between the lines when you're talking to Inuit people about ancestors of theirs. But my sense was that Maggie was already married at the time that she had the affair with Robert Flaherty. I don't know why she had the affair with Robert Flaherty. Maybe she felt obliged. Maybe she loved him. There was a certain amount of status in having a child with a white man at that time. So it could have been a combination of all these things, but it certainly wasn't a very unusual thing for there to be a child of mixed race in a community, an Arctic community. And certainly Josephy would not have had, he wouldn't have suffered any kind of discrimination as a result of this. The children were always welcomed, whatever their racial backgrounds were, and children were a kind of essential part of the family economy too. So from a very early age, Maggie will have been teaching Josephy how to collect grubs in the willow, how to collect little eggs of little Arctic grouse, and then as he got older, maybe to hunt for seabirds and fish. So he would have grown up, to all intents and purposes, Inuit, and thinking of himself as Inuit. And he certainly wouldn't have spoken English. He would have spoken Inuktitut. We do know about Maggie that she died young, but that, again, was nothing surprising in the Arctic of the time. And was a kind of quiet scandal. The white men, white people, when they came up to the Arctic, brought a lot of diseases with them, to which the Inuit had absolutely no immunity. So the rates of death from diseases such as polio, tuberculosis, whooping cough, measles, were tremendous. You could expect if you were an Inuit man or woman living in the 1930s, you could expect to live to about 25.
Up until this point, we have traders, whalers, missionaries. Then in World War II, we have an influx of another white influx, and the Americans during the war built a fort up in the north. So here we have World War II, half a world away, affecting the Inuit. And is that the beginning of the Arctic being drawn into the Cold War?
Yes, that was the beginnings of it. During the war, a lot of American service personnel went to the Canadian Arctic, partly because the transatlantic flying routes then, as now, came over the pole, and there were all sorts of plans for establishing air bases across the Arctic that would then be a stepping stone between the U.S. and Europe. There was even a slightly crazy plan at one point to establish a hospital there for wounded American servicemen, but that was abandoned, I think. Someone recognized that for the piece of craziness that it was. But as the war progressed the U.S. military became more and more interested in the Soviet Union, and subsequently, during the Cold War, the Arctic became of great strategic importance to the United States. And at the same time, it was not really, it hadn't been completely established who actually owned the Arctic, particularly the Eastern Arctic Archipelago. It had been largely discovered by British explorers and Norwegians, and some Americans in the 19th century, but and the British had kind of claimed it just because they could, and because at that time they were administering Canada. But this had never really been established in international law. So even by the 1940s and 50s, it wasn't entirely clear who actually owned that vast tract of land that had become so strategically important as a spying, a series of spying depots for the Soviet Union. After all, the Soviet Union was only about 1,000 miles across the Arctic Ocean from Greenland and from most of the Canadian High Arctic.
So it's April 1953, and Canada has decided before April 1953, I would assume here. I'm just kind of working from my notes, but in April 1953, word came to Inukjuak, to a member of the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Ross Gibson, saying that people were to be moved to the north, the high Arctic. The Inuit were not consulted. What were they told? How did this move happen?
Well, I think it happened almost by accident, in the sense that there had been the various welfare departments of the Canadian government had a concern about Inuit welfare, because the whalers had, and in their turn the fur traders, had concentrated the populations of Inuit around the fur trading posts and the whaling posts, and these were not necessarily the best hunting grounds, and in any case they became crowded, in Arctic terms crowded. So they became very rapidly hunted out, which in turn made the Inuit much more dependent on the fur trade and trapping fox fur particularly. But after the fox fur price was always subject to fashions, and after the war, Second World War, the fashion for fox fur disappeared almost overnight. So the price of fox furs crashed, and the Inuit found themselves in a position where they couldn't support themselves. They had no economy, and the land around them was hunted out. So that was one concern. The other issue was a much more geopolitical one, to do with who actually owned those islands of the eastern Canadian Arctic archipelago. The Americans had been kind of putting out feelers that maybe they'd quite like a slice. A senator had suggested setting up an American air base up there without any reference to the Canadians. The Canadians and the Americans already had joint weather stations up there, and Americans were routinely flying jet planes, military jet planes, across Canadian airspace without reference to the Canadian government. So the Canadian government was deeply concerned about having their land, as it were, taken over, just not by force, but kind of de facto. And the only way to really establish that the land was Canadian was to put Canadians on it. And the only Canadians they figured were likely to survive at that kind of latitude were Inuit people. So the plan was hatched to dispatch these Inuit up to what became the most northerly habitation on the planet. And I should say, this island, Ellesmere, had never been inhabited permanently. There were a couple of weather stations on it, but it was uninhabitable as far as anyone knew. And the Inuit were simply told that fox fur had become a bit scarce and the hunting grounds were a bit overhunted, and they were going to be moved to wonderful hunting grounds and with full of foxes, and they would all be able to look after their families and feed their families. And if they didn't like it, the Canadian government would bring them back to their home. And I think here it's important to stress that for Inuit people, their homeland is their homeland, and their family is everything. That's their lives, and not simply emotionally, but often quite literally, because they're dependent on their families for hunting. And they're dependent on knowing the land in order to be able to hunt on it.
The people who are responsible for telling the Inuit there that there would be fox and that this would be a wonderful place to go to, how did they rationalize that? Did they not realize this was really wrong, inhuman?
Well, for starters, none of the people who came up with this plan or were given the task of enforcing it had ever been to Ellesmere Island, or virtually none of them. None of them had been in the kind of conditions that they were going to subject the Inuit to, so they simply didn't know what they were talking about. They had this sense that the Arctic was all much of a muchness. It was a big white blob, and moving people around in a big white blob wasn't going to make much of a difference to them. And the police on the ground in Inuktitut, who were responsible for the actual everyday organizing, such as it was, of the move, were young, inexperienced. One of them, Ross Gibson, who you mentioned before, he was on his first Arctic posting. These people had no idea.
We're up against the clock now, and I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask, but I'll leave it to one. Family and land, key to survival for the Inuit. And you spoke a while earlier about the Inuit, to speak of the dead is disrespectful. I want to know how you as a journalist work around these cultural sensitivities, and for the rest of us, how could we be more aware, more thinking about the sensitivities, of Indigenous peoples, of people who we are half a world away from?
I hope that my book goes some way towards putting a story that happened to people who are very different from you and I, and think very differently and have very different lives, into a kind of language that you and I can understand and can relate to. I mean, everyone has families, right? Everyone has a sense of home. Everyone has a sense that they want to do their best for their families, and these are universal needs and desires, and it doesn't matter if you're an Inuit living in an Ellesmere Island or me living in London or you in the Chicago area. These are universal human needs. So I think one thinks about what people have in common, which is not just their humanity, which is a terribly grand and abstract-sounding thing, but the everyday realities of the need to provide for their families, the desire to give their kids the best start in life, the desire to have their kids do better in life than they've done themselves. These are as much Inuit desires, and incidentally also Pygmy desires and Navajo desires and the rest of it, as they are desires of people like you and me.
Yeah. I do hope people will read this book, our listeners will read this book, The Long Exile, because also as we think of this, perhaps if people are listening, they might think, well, this is a horrible chapter in the history of humanity. But, you know, coming up in this century, there are new geopolitical challenges in this part of the world. And we haven't had time to talk about that, but it's part of the story as well, or part of another story. A story that is perhaps just beginning. Melanie, thank you very much for speaking with me this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
Melanie McGrath is the author of The Long Exile, A Tale of Inuit Betrayal and Survival in the High Arctic. The book is published by Knopf.